Lend Me Your Ears, the Oral Dramaturgies Podcast. The Gallery, interviews with artists.
Hello, welcome to The Gallery. Sarah Goetz is a non-binary artist based in California whose work exists at the intersection of bodily performance, video, installation and signage. Selected in partnership with Battersea Arts Centre to be supported by the Oral Dramaturgies Project, Saget's work meets the remit of this research in a number of interesting ways. Their video piece, Me and My Army, originally made in 2011, deploys feminist art and theory to reenact and give voice to Mrs. Alexander, the largely marginalized and forgotten character played by Adrienne Corey in Stanley Kubrick's 1971 version of A Clockwork Orange, whose rape sets the action of the film in motion. Goetz's multi-channel video piece Hold Your Tongue from 2017, originally conceived as a one-to-one performance, continues the exploration of sexual violation, this time attempting to give a verbal testimony of an experience while at the same time holding one's tongue around a selection of objects. The developing interest in voice, silence, sound, and more recently ventriloquism is finding its way to a brand new piece, The ABCs and XYZs of LMNs, currently in development, which is an exploration of trans and queerphobic scientific rhetoric. In the conversation that follows, Sarah Goetz shares the specificities of their journey towards performance art via combined interest in technology, politics, and art theory. They generously reveal the provenance of specific works from their catalogue by dissecting personal experiences, offering intriguing reflections, and introducing new ways of thinking about orality and aurality. This conversation took place by Zoom on the 31st of May 2020 between London and San Francisco. So, Sarah, thank you very much for your time and for agreeing to talk to us about your work. I've been trying to refresh my memory just looking at your website. Of course, I saw some samples of your work and we talked about your work when we originally met. What we normally do in this conversation is we try and understand the artist and their way of working by reference to where they come from as an artist. So what your journey has been, what formative influences have shaped the way in which you work as an artist, and what training has informed it or has caused you to resist it or rebel against it? What in your cultural milieu has in some ways determined your aesthetics and your methodologies? If we go back to those early formative experiences, where would you sort of place your point of departure? What was the important thing for you that you drew you, where you kind of began to think about expressing yourself as an artist in a particular way?
My mom is fond of telling this story of I was like, I don't know, around 6 years old or something like that, and helping her clean out the car and pulled out a tassel that had fallen off of something and a candy wrapper, like cellophane wrapper, and put them together and started speaking through it as if it was a character. And the candy wrapper was the like wings of this character and the tassel was the body. And the playfulness that art can allow, I think that that is my point of departure. I've been thinking a lot lately about this idea of something that's heliotropic, meaning like a sunflower, something that is following the sun. A lot of my work lately has actually been very much about organic matter, like looking into what does it take for something to grow. And one of the other things about that candy wrapper scenario that I think is fairly emblematic for me is that on a like visceral core level, it is important to me to examine wastefulness. Like wastefulness is something that really motivates me. Waste in general really motivates me. So a lot of what I've done in my life has, as an artist, from a time period when I was making sculpture to a time period when I was doing only performance and a time period when I was doing only video. It was mostly about using the scraps of what was around and playing the only thing that's necessary in order to create something out of nothing, out of the scraps that are just the byproducts of daily life, is a lot of imagination, and imagination comes from play. So that is the most general summary that I could possibly give. But like, for example, this project, the ABCs and XYZs of LMN about lemons, has brought me to a place of thinking about, I eat lemons whole, like apples. And one of the things that I'm always noticing with artwork is that there's things that I just do in my life and I never think of them as being strange until somebody confronts me with it, reflects it back at me and says, wow, that's really weird that you eat lemons like that. And this has happened at every party I've ever gone to in my life where there's a lemon, or every dinner, you know, you get a lemon as a garnish and you're supposed to just squeeze it onto the plate and then throw it away. Some lemons are nicer than others, but I can taste the difference between like an organic lemon and a not organic lemon because I'm eating the rind. Mm-hmm. And organic is, you know, it's a buzzword, it's a catchphrase, it's a whatever, but it's also something that I've been trying to critically examine in terms of my own relationship to consumption and climate change, and that being part of a greater problem. So when I'm doing something like eating a lemon and eating the rind, I feel like I am confronting what that lemon is all the way down. I can't forget that shell. And that, I think, is like the most important factor of this thing that I said about wastefulness, is it's that if I'm using something, I want to use the whole thing. And I think that way about ideas too, but it gets tricky. That actually is where it gets really tricky, because sometimes I'm like, I would like to reference this, but to reference something also might mean like ingesting it or promoting it, which is very hard for certain materials that I would like to use. So one thing that I did in the project Me and My Army was that I was absolutely under the surface referencing Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. Mm-hmm. Which I did theater very early in like my teenage years. And I loved that play. I loved the idea of what is happening in the background when everybody else is on stage. Like, what is happening in that off-screen space? And in some ways, I do think of that as similar to that lemon rind. It's like, what is this thing that we're ignoring is the excess? Is the temporary, is the throwaway.
In what you've just said so far, we've heard about a number of different strands that your work has taken. You had an artistic output as a sculptor. You just mentioned your early association with theater, making theater practice as a teenager and so on. And now you're making performance that draws on a number of different media as well. I understand your academic training has been in the areas of arts and communications, art and technology and so on. Can you take us on that journey through those choices you were making as a young person? So I want to return to that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, actually, if you don't mind, because this is totally kind of a project about dramaturgies and theatres. So
absolutely.
Going back to those teenage years of doing theater, what was that encounter like and where did it take place?
I was a very shy kid, but I wasn't, but I was. And I recently heard the expression ambivert, so both an introvert and an extrovert, and that's absolutely what I would consider myself. And even now, like, I shoot alone for the most part. I set up the camera, I perform in front of it, and then I go look at the footage, and then I do it again, look at the footage and do it again. Mm-hmm. One very formative moment for me was I had this theater teacher who I think she was a little just irritated at how quiet I was. I was probably 10 years old, 11, 12, I don't know, something like that. And standing on stage, and she was like, you need to project. And she could not explain projecting to me. I just didn't get it. And finally, I was working with some tech folk because I was like, I can't be on the stage. I'll just help. And at one point, we were prepping something, and I needed to say something very quickly to somebody who was at the back of this proscenium theater. And I was on stage. So I didn't yell, I projected for the first time. And this teacher turns around and she said, Sarah, this is it. That's what projection is. Do it again. And she made me do it again. And I could feel it in my body. That feeling when you are using your full lung capacity to speak. And I love that. I love it. But now, especially living in the Bay Area, we're like on top of each other, almost literally. I live with five people. We live in this place where it's like, there's somebody right above me. There's somebody right above them. There's somebody right above them. And we are all on top of each other all the time, separated by thin walls, and the temptation to kind of like curl your shoulders in and take up less space and to be quiet. And especially as someone assigned female at birth, there's like this like wanting to like hide these feminine features that's like part of my physical life. Whereas like opening up, using my full chest is actually how I get the voice that I want from myself. And learning that was so hard. It was just an incredibly difficult thing. And I feel like I have to constantly relearn it now. So these days, like, there's only two spaces in the Bay Area that I've ever been that I feel like I can try to make work. And one of them is in my partner's car. Because when I'm on the highway, nobody can hear me. And the other space, it's in a giant studio warehouse. It's a studio inside of a warehouse. One side is an elevator shaft. On the other side is the bathroom. So there's no studios abutting it. And I can actually work out loud in that space. And that has been, I think, one of the strangest and most beautiful parts about that early life in theater, actually, was that is a space that I can enter in when there is an audience. But when there's a real audience, it's a different experience than when there's a camera. And that is actually part of what took me into art and tech things, is that I actually started in 16 millimeter film, which had no sound. And I was really interested in what communication looked like without sound. And a lot of that meant shooting text and having, and I since then have gone far into this world of how did silent filmmakers do text. I have a day job right now working at an archive for typefaces. So my day job has me regularly inside of what does text look like on the screen, on the page, on film. And it's besides Zoom, it's all we have. There are these are text messages and usually muted video. And that's the other thing that like, I feel like I moved into looking at the history of silent cinema and got to ventriloquism, but that's a whole other line, because I was constantly in this position of feeling like I needed to be able to function in a small space, in a controlled space, in a quiet space, and not bother anybody. So the not bothering anybody, meaning like definitely don't project your voice because you're going to bother your neighbor, was one of the things that sort of like, it took me into film because I could work on film so quietly and then it could be so big and loud. Like if it's a silent film, you don't need a rehearsal space where you can make noise, but you do. Like this is where I'm at right now, is this, I feel like a caged animal a little because I haven't been able to sing loudly. I think that that idea of the good children are seen and not heard idea was something I think I took a little bit too much to heart as a child and have been trying to unlearn ever since, and did it briefly inside of theater, but then realized that in film I could do both. Although I miss that theater pushes me towards it. And I know that when I'm in front of an audience, I'm still putting on that acting as an MC, you know, like it's turns into this whole other self.
My legs are trembling. I am standing here in front of you, and you're sitting over there. My arms are 32 inches in length. My legs are 65. My hair is growing out. I'm 29 years old. I am speaking and projecting out to you while you are sitting over there, and I am standing right here. You are over there, and I am right here. I am speaking in a performative manner while you are sitting as my audience looking at me. You are over there, and I am right here. I am right here, and you are over there. You are over there, and I am right here. I am right here, standing while you are over there.
When you started working with 16mm film, was that before college?
In undergrad.
And what was the actual undergrad degree that you did?
There were three. So it was visual and media studies, documentary studies, and arts of the moving image, which is their video program. So I did all three.
And then what was that choice determined by? What did you imagine this was going to contribute towards your journey as an artist?
Honestly, I think I was a little short-sighted at the time. I was very like, I just want to take these classes. And this is where the fun is, was a lot of it for me. And then also a little bit of like, at the time I was like, well, if I know my way around technology, then I can be employed. Coming from a very middle-class background, that was a consideration. So I was like, all right, I will learn how to do basic coding. I will learn how to, and in grad school, it was like, okay, I will teach Photoshop and Illustrator and processing. I will learn how to program an Arduino. I know the basics of physical computing and robotics. So these kinds of things were, partly it was just interesting. And returning back to that wastefulness question, one of the things that always bothered me was I used to take stuff apart, like in high school. I would just find tech around and take it apart because I was like, what is this? What's inside of that? And I think I'm technically a millennial, so I'm on that like older edge of them. But still, I grew up having seen The Matrix and was very curious about what happens inside of the black box of a computer. So I went into my undergrad with a little bit of like, I want to know these things because they're part of my contemporary world, and also a little bit of disdain for that because I liked being physical. I liked taking up space in real space, which is a lot of what I think kind of brought me to this project, this question of like, can I perform with the video? And these days it's like, well, even if I am performing with the video, it's still through a screen. So I have some questions about that, but yeah, some of it was just practical and a lot of it was curiosity. And I loved the faculty in the film department. The classes were more fun. Experimental film was just mind-blowing to me. And it was partly because I could see a lineage in, I think I was using Final Cut Pro at the time. And I could, one of the teachers who taught editing had started her career working as an editor of 16 and then on 35 and then on VHS and then had essentially spent her career growing up with film. And she one day gave this beautiful presentation about how all of the tools that you're using inside of, when I teach it, it's now Premiere usually, inside of Premiere, Final Cut Pro, or any sort of video editing software online, all of that is coming from a language that was developed by hand. So to cut literally was to cut. There's a thing called a ripple roll. And why is it called a roll? Well, you were actually rolling the film. So some of it was just like a good teacher. Her name is Shambhu B. Kaul. She was great at teaching me, somebody who really loved working with their hands, how to see the computer as just an extension. So some curiosity, some practicality, and a good deal of good educators.
And did you always envisage that you would be pursuing a career as an artist when you were doing this degree?
Yes and no. There's a thing called magnet programs in the US. It was an attempt to counter white flight in the US. What they would be an inner city school that was funded very, very well, and they would bus people from all over the school district. So in from the suburbs, in from another part of the inner city, and they would fund it specifically for some sort of like career path training thing. And it's public, it's not a private school, but just kind of specially oriented towards something. So I had been in engineering. I like math. I like things that make sense. I still do. And love spreadsheets. I use them all the time in my work currently, just as part of the flow. And so I had been planning to be an engineer. And when my parents moved to another state, I went to a different high school that was oriented toward the arts, and honestly just discovered that art was so much harder than math. And at the time, it was just the challenge. Like, I was addicted to it, addicted to this like weirdness of like knowing that I had made a piece that I thought was good, and at the time not knowing why I thought it was good or how to do that again. And now I don't try to do that thing again. But but it made a difference at the time.
What kind of art was that?
I had to choose an art track in high school. And I chose visual arts. So it was drawing and painting at that moment. I'm not a good painter. Never was. But I was doing collage work, which I guess I still do, actually. I think that's not a bad way to talk about the work that I make. Because it's a lot of picking vignettes from things that I like, not really caring how many people get the homage, and knowing that, like, if I pick something up from a Kenneth Anger movie, it might just be there for me, but that's part of how I orient myself as when I'm performing for the cameras, like thinking, okay, now I am a combination of Jean Dielman from Jean Dielman, the movie, and I am also Adrian Corey from A Clockwork Orange. And I am also, I can't even remember, like just pick one of them and put it in.
Yeah.
I still think of it as like a collage of information or of personality. And knowing that those are the sticky notes around when I'm about to go shoot that scene.
Mm-hmm. So when was it that you graduated from your undergraduate degree? Which year?
2011.
And then you did an MFA in art and technology. And actually, there is quite a lot of engagement with theoretical thinking. You describe your work as being about theory and practice. So yeah. Was that already a feature of your like interest during your undergraduate studies? What was the choice about doing an MFA about?
I actually have been considering on and off going to do a PhD because art and technology is where I felt the interesting theory was. Not that there's not interesting theory in other things, but that was a lot of the people that I think are doing really interesting, radical, theoretical queer engagement are working in art and technology fields. And there are some local people that I could give you as an example that are local to the Bay Area, like Dorothy Santos, who's like somebody that I'm a big fan of, or like Misha Cardenas. Misha, I saw her work when I was an undergrad, and listening to her talk about why she makes games and how that for her could be a space to explore what radical queer community could look like or a future. It's just that those were the people in art that I thought were paying the most attention. Not all of art and technology by a long shot, but those are the conferences that got my brain buzzing. I like performance conferences too. I've been to a couple. But it's always with this, like, well, we have to confront this. Technology is just part of everything now. It's part of all of it. And if we aren't thinking about it, it's using us. And so one of the most interesting books that I've read recently is by Jenny O'Dell. It's called How to Do Nothing, Resisting Control in the Attention Economy. I'm misquoting the subtitle. But it is this question of like, well, if I have Instagram on my phone, I will be on it at least 1 hour a day. So I don't have Instagram on my phone because I don't want my whole life to be in that space. I actually, in graduate school, had a major physical problem because of all of the looking, all of this position mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. one's body when you're like looking down like this. Mm-hmm. Theory is what got me into film. Mm-hmm. I loved film theory because it was so much about just how do you communicate? How can we think about the way that it impacts an audience? But also, how do you control? I was very bothered by film, still am. Still don't really watch that many without a lot of cushioning of my life because I think film is too powerful. I don't like how powerful it is. I don't like being taken on a ride when I don't know where it's going. And the emotional ride that film takes you on is something that I wanted to engage with. So I started reading film theory. And one of my favorite essays is by Marianne Doan, and she talks about how the voice works on screen. So what is it when somebody's off screen and you hear their voice? And how does the sound manipulation create a presence of that voice? So like the voice of God versus like somebody whose voice is faded left. Those questions were so interesting to me because they helped me break down what was the idea of authority and where does authority sit in a space? And as a maker, when do I want to claim that, but also can I escape it, has been a very major question for me for a long time. And so dialogue being absent from a lot of my work is something that I've toyed with for a long time because I have a lot to say, but I don't know that that's a place for it. So I write essays alongside of things frequently.
At what point did you move to the Bay Area?
After grad school. That was in 2011.
What prompted this decision? Was it part of an artistic choice or was it simply life circumstances? Mm-hmm.
I had a fellowship, the Daedalus Foundation Fellowship, right at the end of graduate school. And so I could go anywhere in theory. And the Bay Area was kind of a bizarre choice because so many people I know were like, go to Berlin, go to Philadelphia, go to Chicago. And I love those places very much. But there was a space here, actually. I'm now, that my day job is now working for this space that I wanted to do research here. That's really what it was that the Letterform Archive was just so interesting. I had come on a visit to the Bay and did a short visit in the Letterform Archive looking for, at the time I was looking for people's type decisions in film. So in my video that's on my website, Me and My Army, which was my thesis video for grad school, I did a bunch of research at the time on the typeface that was used in Clockwork Orange, which was what the piece is about, and then stumbled across this whole set of materials in this archive revealing a tendency of people to put bodies into the alphabet. And I was just fascinated, completely fascinated by this trend. I actually just wrote a piece, a short essay about this trend at the archive. But not just at the archive, just in the history of people writing and printing in the Latin alphabet anyway. So I was really, I got fascinated with this because I think for me, the whole thing about silence and voices and silent film is just the disconnection between what is being expressed and the body itself. And that's ventriloquism too. It's just this, this disconnection and then reconnection of like allowing the body and voice to be separated or projected or put into someone else. I remember in I think in undergrad was the first time that somebody was, at the time they were like, Web 2.0, let's talk about that in theory. And nobody ever says those words anymore. But they're like, okay, Web 2.0, that's like Twitter, where people, it's not just people publishing on websites, it's social media. And I remember one of the things that was so remarkable to me about early web stuff was copy and paste, just the basics. Mm-hmm. And that it is easy to take another's words, to take another's voice and use it and say it's your own.
You've mentioned Me and My Army as being your graduation piece. Maybe we should talk about it a bit more, but maybe for the benefit of the listener as well, I don't mind if you describe it, if you kind of tell us a bit more in a bit more detail how it came about, why, what you intended to do with that.
Yeah, I maybe should have just started here because it definitely sums up a lot of the things that I've said so far. So I mentioned earlier that I part of the reason I got into film theory was because I felt like film was too powerful. And part of the reason that I felt that film was too powerful was because I was a voracious reader as a teenager, as a kid. And as a teenager, just worked my way through every dystopian novel that's ever been written, pretty much. Like I was very obsessed, and I loved A Clockwork Orange. And I loved that book because of the way that you got to learn a language, because a language was invented inside of it. And so one of the things that's interesting to me about that as a book is that you are inside of the mind of Alex, the main character, but all of the things that he does are described essentially from the point of view of a sociopath, because that's what the character is. There is no empathy for any other character, for any of the harm that he does, none of that. So reading that book, it's horrific, but it is still, it is not a horror that I am asked to participate in personally, which is maybe the danger of the book too. But I thought it was clever and was a preteen, and I liked movies. So I watched a movie as a 12-year-old, which was a bad idea, I think, because it was really upsetting. It was really upsetting. And Me and My Army is probably a decade's or more worth of like processing of what seeing that movie did to me as like a young person assigned female at birth. And at the time, without any kind of vocabulary to talk about transness, about gender identity, at that time, just operating in the world, being seen as a young woman. And there's nothing in either the book or the movie that even close to addresses what it is to be a woman in that world. And it is perhaps one of the most objectifying pieces of literature that I've read. But yeah, so there's no sympathy or empathy for women in that space. And the movie, I think, is worse because it plays with where you identify yourself. And so one of the things that I've written about that piece was that, and this is why I say that I have a theory practice thing, is because writing about other work helps me understand what I need to do, what I need to do in response. I had one teacher one time, I had asked him, when you find out that somebody made an artwork that you really, really liked and that you think, oh, I wish I had made that. He was like, oh, I never think that. I just think, oh, now I don't have to do that. Somebody else did it. I'm free to do something else now. So my biggest problems with Clockwork Orange was partly the movie itself.
Just singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling. I'm happy again. The lightning and clouds so dark up above. The sun's in my heart and I'm ready for love. Let the stormy clouds chase. Everyone from the place. Come on with the rain, I've a smile on my face as I walk down the lane with a happy refrain. I'm just singing, singing in the rain.
It is constructed so that you identify with this sociopath. You actively sympathize with him. It's also constructed so that you, in the moment that Adrian Corey is being sexually assaulted in the very beginning of the film, you identify with her husband who is bound. But you identify with him just so that you can watch this happen, which just, it kind of just isn't necessary. So the gratuitous violence of that moment is upsetting to me. But also that character, that male character, gets a name. He is Frank Alexander. And Alex, you identify with Alex the whole movie, but this character, who is actually the linchpin of the whole movie, without this character being sexually assaulted, you don't have the rest of the movie. Alex never gets found. He never gets put into this brainwashing device. So without her, you have nothing. But she doesn't have a name. She has no first name, and she has no last name. She has her husband's last name. And I was so upset by this, but the thing that really got me about A Clockwork Orange was how all of these faculty, all of these people just kept showing it over and over and over again without any sort of regard to what that does to the mostly young people and often like young women in the audience who, if they haven't experienced sexual assault, statistically, they are likely to. In that time period, and having experienced it myself, it's like, it is not something that I really want to see in a film class. And not to say that we shouldn't show these movies, but it was also not couched. It was not, it's not put next to something like Jean Dielman. And that was my real goal with Me and My Army, was that I wanted to take this movie that is genuinely a great movie. It is well constructed. The soundtrack is brilliantly made. The way that it manipulates you into actually liking this character is really powerful, upsetting but powerful. So I thought it was a brilliant movie. And I just wanted to do something for myself that would allow me to talk about it with people. Because I was realizing over the years, I realized that every time I went to some event and got talking with some filmmaker guy, you know, you're always in these spaces where like you're the only not cis guy there. And I mean, constantly like working in technology and also working in film. And they'll like talk to you about the number of times I've had some guy just sitting and talking to me. And he's like, oh yeah, what are your favorite films? And he'll say A Clockwork Orange. And I'm like, all right, I will never trust you again. And, but like, I want to be able to like, not immediately go into a mental hole with that. I didn't want to have to like go to the bathroom and recover myself in order to continue that conversation. So Me and My Army became this film for me. It was like almost like a manifesto of like, this is who is behind me whenever I am confronted with misogyny, confronted with sexism, confronted with this mistreatment, and confronted with just the sheer ignorance of the people talking to me and considering this to be like a valid way to speak. Anyway, the reason why it got made, when and how it did, was that Adrian Corey died in 2010, I think. Maybe it was 2009, but this is kind of really roundabout. It was actually because Carrie Fisher died.
Right.
So Carrie Fisher died, and I was upset about that. And then went into this whole thing and didn't really realize that Carrie Fisher was the daughter of Debbie Reynolds. When Carrie Fisher died, I started just like thinking about how much I cared about her as a person, as an actress, but also just as a person. And I was like, you know what I don't know? I don't know the name of the woman who played that role, who's, you know, apparent sexual assault on screen meant so much to me and hurt me so much. Who is she? What was her life? What was like all of that? So I just looked her up. Her name is Adrian Corey. And she didn't have a name on screen, like I said. So I was like, I just really want everybody to know her name. It was 2 minutes of her life. And I started doing all this research to find out stuff about her and started reading her obituaries, the same way I had done with Carrie Fisher. And kind of found this weird moment where she described herself as Debbie Reynolds in relationship to Alex, that into that character, because of the Singing in the Rain thing. So I looked into Singing in the Rain. I looked into, I rewatched Clockwork Orange, which was hard. And then I watched John Dielman again, because I think it's one of the best revenge movies that's ever been made. And I love it. I just love that film. Chantal Ackerman had also died sometime in that time period. So I was just thinking a lot about her as a filmmaker. And she's a continuously inspiring figure to me. So I looked into it, and Adrian Corey's obituaries ranged from being 20% to being 80% about, like, word count only about A Clockwork Orange. She was in several other films as a leading person. This was 2 minutes, 2 minutes in the film. And I was upset that so few people knew her for anything else. She was also an amateur art historian. She wrote a novel. Like, she had a life. And I wanted to get to know her as best I could. And since I couldn't really get to know her, I decided to put myself in her body as much as I could. So I made her costume for that scene. I decided, though, that I think I described earlier, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, this is like off-screen space. And so I was thinking about, like, what was her day like before that? Like, what was her day like after that? Like, they just leave, apparently, and she dies not long after is the plot point. But like, what did she do right after that? And so I kept thinking about all of the amazing works of feminist artwork that I've seen and mentally collected over the years. A lot of them are performances, a lot of them are videos, a lot of them are music or books. There's just things that have rooted me, have grounded me when I've felt like I was floating off into a world of the patriarchy. And I wanted to, like I said, build an army of these people for her. So I think I did that. I mean, I reenacted all of these people. And like I said earlier, I felt it as a collage of like John Dielman, Adrian Corey, Valley Export, like trying to put these people in the same room. Well, Chantal Ackerman, but John Dielman as the fictional character in that room. And just see like what happens when they get to be together. Does Adrian Corey's character die? I don't know, probably not. But like, I've showed this movie at a bunch of film festivals, and one of the things that always happens is that I get to say Adrian Corey over and over and over again. And everybody leaves knowing her name. And it makes me so happy. And actually the ventriloquism research has sort of turned into a thing about Terry Rogers. So that little bit of like documentary background also from undergrad has constantly come back in, because I always do a lot of research whenever I'm making something. And some of it's kind of biographical, some of it's scientific, and Terry Rogers will be the person that I tell you about next. But
great.
Leave it there.
Can't wait, yes. So when you made it in that academic context, did it have the installation form that I've seen on your website, this iteration of it with the scissors and the hanging in the three screens?
Yeah.
Yes. Was it conceived as an installation from the start?
Was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It was. I mean, since then, I actually did a re-edit of it in 2018 because mm-hmm. it was being shown at SF MoMA at Crossroads, and I couldn't do an installation in that space. And I also just didn't want to. I wanted it to be on the big screen. And I had shown it as a three-channel piece in theaters. And then I just decided to re-edit it. I missed getting to see the text flash more frequently. I missed that. But I also, when I re-edited it that way, the figure got to take up more space on screen. And I just really loved that so much that, yeah, it felt worthwhile. But I do miss the scissors. I carry those scissors with me everywhere I go, actually. They're just in my mobile studio kit.
So that returning to the materiality that also kind of informs your practice. And I noticed that actually that is still a feature of some of the works that I've seen on your website. So some of these are performances and some of them are described as multi-channel or single channel video loops intended to be exhibited in galleries, presumably. Do you have a phase when you are kind of focusing on either live performance and then going back to the more multimedia work, or does it go in parallel for you?
I think it goes in parallel, but I also, I'm less interested in gallery in general than I was. I think lately I prefer live performance and screenings to making installations at the moment. I value installations because of the multi-channel aspect of them. I still do them, but I don't pursue doing them as much as I pursue doing live work.
What does the multi-channel aspect of it afford for you?
They can talk to each other. That's really what it boils down to, is that I get to see them as multiple figures that have a relationship to each other. The other thing that I like about multi-channel work, on a certain scale that I very rarely get to do, especially in the Bay, is I like the way it takes up bodily space. Like I like standing, if Me and My Army is on screen for a proscenium theater space, then Me and I Army, that the character's a lot larger than everyone in the room. And I like that. I mean, there is a part of me that's just attracted to things like color field painting. Like if you're right next to a gigantic red canvas, you feel that. And multi-channel work can do that. And I also love that, like, you have a little bit more room to play with sound, to play with where sounds are coming from. But it's the kind of thing that it needs a lot of support, a lot of institutional support to be able to do that in the way that I want. And whereas I can take some of the same material, make a single channel video, and then it just sees more people. More people see it, but really it sees them, is like how I tend to think of it, is that like they get to be introduced, yay. And because every time I show my work somewhere, I try to go, because I love the Q&As. They're very exciting and inspiring to me. So I love multi-channel work for the ways that it can communicate with itself. And multi-channel work was part of what got me into film. So I have like a deep fondness for it. When I was living in North Carolina, and I got on a train and went to Washington, D.C. to go to I think this was in high school, actually. It was the first time that I ever went to a like really, really well-funded museum. And I went to the Hirshhorn Museum, which at the time was showing a thing that was called Realisms. I think that was the name of the show. And I saw Mother Father, which is a Candace Bright's piece. And it was a six-channel conversation between different mother figures in movies. There are six of them. Some of the actresses that are coming to mind are like Meryl Streep, Diane Keaton, a few other people that famous movies. Julie Roberts from Stepmother, I think, was one of them. They were having a conversation. Sometimes they were talking to each other, and then sometimes they were talking together as a chorus. And I was just so fascinated by that dynamic of like, it felt like an internal conversation and then would switch and become something that, it's almost like if your mind were divided into six characters and then occasionally they agree, so then you act on that one. Yeah, I mean, Candice Bright has always been like a major influence on me. I love her work. Partly because I think she's also just really like fun and sometimes very funny. I feel like for me to be really motivated for a piece, it needs to be like somewhat equal parts anger and comedy. Then I want to work on it because I'm like, it's cathartic and also I'm having a really fun time. Then I'm willing to spend hours and hours and weeks, days, years on it.
I'm aware that your work is quite autobiographical in some ways, and so I'm not sure what are safe questions to ask and what are not.
You can ask me whatever.
But one moment I wanted to look into, or like two pieces I wanted to ask you about together, was the Hold My Tongue and the Hold Your Tongue piece. Mm. And one of them is like a one-to-one interactive live performance that's Hold My Tongue. And the other one is Hold Your Tongue, which is a 26-channel video loop. And are they interrelated? I mean, or is that just a coincidence that they have a similar name?
One followed the other. So the one-on-one performance is kind of a weird thing. So I made that before Me and My Army. And I was reenacting the conditions of a sexual assault that actually happened to me. But I was also using it as a way to tell people in my life about it, because I hadn't, at that point, I had told one person And it was like a very, it was intense and it was problematic because the, like, I was constantly frustrated by the fact that the common story, the person, my assaulter, that's the word, was somebody that people knew, didn't live anywhere near me at the time, but that people knew through the art world. And I was like, just uncomfortable. I couldn't, it was frustrating not to be able to talk about it. And to provide some context to, because it happened right before I went to grad school, like a few months before I went to grad school. And I got there just kind of reeling with like advisors who knew this person, and we would talk about him because his work mattered and it mattered to me and still does. But so hold my tongue and hold your tongue are two different approaches to the same material. Hold my tongue was a piece in which I wrote prompt cards. These prompt cards, I would go into somebody's space, say their office or their studio or their house or whatever. And I had prearranged, I would say, would you do a performance with me? It'll take about 20 minutes. I'll pick you up and I'll drop you off. And the performance will take place in my car. And I would come to their place, hand them a card that said, I will not be speaking except when I say my part in this role. And then I would lead them into my car. On the front of the prompt card would be an instruction, like, follow me. On the back of the prompt card would be some sort of statement, if I remember correctly. It's been a few years. I had people put on gloves just so it was less weird. And then I would have them hold my tongue. Okay. Mm-hmm. And now I have them with her. In talking to them in that way, I would tell them the whole story. Whatever came to mind. And I was recording it. Oh, yeah, that was another thing. That one of the prompt cards said, you will be recorded. I was wearing a GoPro on my head, and I had a sound recorder, H4. And the GoPro, all it would really see is the tongue being held, and very little else. So you can't see the faces of anybody. You can't see my face. You can't see theirs. You can see a little bit of what we're both wearing. And then, so basically what I did was I picked people up. I drove them to somewhere and stopped, and they would hold my tongue. I would tell them the story. And then also true, so it was a reenactment, is I would get out of the car and we would hug. And that's part of the story, but in the real thing that happened to me, the hug was not a good thing. And the in the telling of the story, the hug was a great thing. And so with many of the people that I did it with, I would then go on a walk with them and we would talk about what it was, about the context of it. In some cases, I told them the actual real story out loud. But I felt that this like decompressing afterwards was very crucial. And finally, I stopped doing it when somebody told me that it really upset them. And I asked her why, and we spent a long time talking about it. And she was the only person who had, she was a dancer. She is a dancer and a friend. And we talked about like what it was to do a performance outside of the context of a performance space, and how like the lack of known start, the lack of known end, meant that there was like some extra vulnerability that I was asking for, and that I was giving too. So it felt kind of equal, but that one moment made me stop doing it. And then, but it didn't feel done. I mean, it did shift my relationship to the content a little, which is important to me, but it also, it gave me a little bit of a framework for thinking about what it was to like speak out loud without being intelligible. And then I became very interested in, I had been doing alphabetic work for a bit before that, but the alphabet pieces that came after it were really kind of focused on like, when somebody makes a work that's based in the alphabet, it's usually a way to structure something that can't be structured. And there's no real way to structure trauma. I don't think that has a good structure. And like, I never want to reenact trauma. That's why I feel like my work usually ends up being really celebratory and fun. Even when it's not easy or easy to watch, I struggle watching some of my work. And Hold Your Tongue became a very different piece than Hold My Tongue. And there's a little bit of footage from Hold My Tongue that is in Hold Your Tongue. But it was almost a, not really a joke, but almost a joke in that Hold Your Tongue was, it started with A, hold your tongue with an Abecedarian film. B, hold your tongue with a book. C, hold your tongue with a clamp. D, hold your tongue with a donut. And what I did in this one, instead of individually talking to people in real life, what I did was I picked an object and I picked 26 people to address.
When I see an artwork that I like, I don't think of myself, oh, I'm so ill. Yes. Your voice. How about a fair play?
How? I take one. What you call after call truth or understanding with physically put your voice drop.
This is what I'm saying. How good I am. I'm fucking tragedy. I'm not tragedy. This is a disappointment. Who takes this the way I want to take it?
An exercise in uses of pressure.
If we have 15 gender,
you have to have curves.
You can do the work to be honest. The funny color of the other solar force of the daily contact with. Did you know you have an easy escape route?
Then in the installation version of it, I actually had a label on it saying who each one was addressed to, but in their initials. So to DG or to LM. So each one of them has a very different tone. And like, hold your tongue with Q-tips was one. And that one is just, it's just really silly. Like, I was laughing the entire time. Hold your tongue with ice was so hard. It just physically really hard. And hold your tongue with a ring. T is the one that really gets me, because it was hold your tongue with your teeth. Like, ha, ha, ha. And even me watching myself do it, it's like I do this empathetic thing where I'm like, I hold my tongue like that watching it. And a lot of where that was coming from was that I was curious just about this like addressing thing. Like, if I'm addressing a camera and I know who it is and it's very different each time, what happens? So it still had to be one-on-one. Like, it still had to be to somebody, because otherwise I didn't know what to say. Because there's nothing to say. It doesn't feel like there's anything to say. Like, oh, a traumatic thing happened to me. But with each of these people, it's like with Q, I was laughing the whole time because the person I was addressing was a dear friend who had also gone through similar things. And I knew that the way that she would want to handle it would be making up stories and joking. And then another one was addressing the actual person. And that one is just like, it's brutally honest and vicious, but nobody can understand it, so it's okay. Mm-hmm. But I've subtitled it. I've played with the footage on and off for years, because I never really think, especially because my work, I often make it for installation and then it's turns into these other things. I've used material from that in performances. I've used material from that as short vignettes that are going in between other people's films. That's the most recent iteration of it, actually. And I don't see the life of footage as limited to a single project. Not now, not digitally. It just doesn't seem to be crucial.
So this interest in orality that occurs in your work in very different ways, you know, both in terms of the interest in voice, off-screen voice, on-screen voice that you mentioned earlier as being influential in terms of the essay that you read. Mm-hmm. In this case, the actual physicality of the mouth and working with it in performance. And then also the ongoing interest in ventriloquism. Where does it come from for you, or are you aware of the way in which it keeps recurring, or is it entirely incidental?
I mean, there's one very easy, accessible thing, which is that I like to talk. I like verbally processing information. I think that when I'm really stuck on something, talking it out with people is part of it. But I think I can actually sum this up even better, which is with a quote. I think it's Lynn Hyginian. I think I'm mispronouncing that last name. I think it was notes from a reading circle that was happening in San Francisco in the 70s. And it's like a short essay-ish thing called Who is Speaking? And in it, she says that, I may be misquoting, but I think this is the right place. She talks about how when you say words out loud, that they just dissipate into the room and the sound reverberates for a little while, but then it's gone. And I think the thing that I'm so interested in about speaking is that it can be there. And when you're speaking to someone, it doesn't really go away entirely when it's gone. So I tend to think of it as like something that's like fading. It's like, you know, when you breathe into a cold night and you can see your breath just kind of go away, but it's there for a while. And there's something about, that's why I like silent film, is that when you put text on screen, there's this there's a duration that it has limit. And when you say words out loud, there's also a duration, but you don't know the limit of the impact of those words.
It's interesting because it's a dialectical interest, because silence is also very important.
One of the things that I've noticed about myself as an artist is sometimes I'm just not that interested in hearing myself speak.
I would like to kind of latch on to one particular phrase I found in one of the documents on your website, where you talk about how your work is a lot about amplifying marginalized voices.
Amplifying marginalized voices is something that I never do by myself. That is something that I participate in with other people. I mean, I would say that silence is much more a part of what I would call my own practice. Amplifying is something that's work that I do in supporting organizations that I am part of, because I've always thought of myself as balancing between trying to make some palpable change in the world and also trying to process it. And I think that one of the things that I used to say to myself, that if I could write it down, if I could make the work into a sentence, then I don't need to make the work, because that's a moment for something else. So if I say, like, here's a marginalized voice, I don't need to do anything except for give them the mic. And yeah, so the work that I've done around that is mostly with places like Control Shift Collective, organizations that are in my community. So yeah, I think my own work is much more about silence.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, it kind of goes into this territory, especially with how you've been describing your current interest in how we watch videos on our phones with the sound off, but with the titling. I'm also thinking of some of the other works that I've seen just recently as part of COVID, where what seems to be happening is that works might be exploiting the orality of the digital sphere. But this orality, you know, I don't know, chatbots talking to each other, as in Annie Dorson's work, or we saw a German artist do something similar as well, which is speaking to the audience through the desktop and through the text boxes in the desktop. This move towards digital orality, that is a kind of silence in itself, but at the same time, it is communication. I don't know to what extent you are sort of doing this with theoretical input from any reading that you might be taking into consideration, or whether it's still on the intuitive level.
Right now, this particular thing is intuitive, but not. Like, I find that when I'm reading a lot of theory, all I want to do is write, and mm-hmm. I just write essays. Mm-hmm. And I like doing that. I very much do, but like, so I feel like I spent at least half of May and April just working on this blog post that's going to come out. So that it's, that one is actually not that theory heavy, but sitting inside of writing is a very critical space, and reading is also a very critical space. But when I'm working on making something, I have to see it in the periphery. So the theory is there, but it's right here instead of right here. I think that's one of those, like, ask me in like a year.
Okay. Okay. That's good. I know that you need to go as well, but before you do go, so there are two things that we could possibly touch on, and this is the interest in neo-ventriloquism, as you called it, and possibly this new piece that you've mentioned already that is in development currently. And where is it? What stage are you at with it? But maybe for the benefit of the listener, again, we could kind of just contextualize it a little bit, what the intention was. Yeah, yeah. So this is ABC, XYZ of LMN.
So ABC and XYZ of LMN is a project that's taking a similar approach to similar content, but from completely different directions. So ABCs of Elimin is the ABCs of Limin, which is a scientifically informed, sort of like a kid's television show about lemons. So about the acid, about how you can use lemon acid to make a battery, how you might cook with it, what it does to temperature, how do you grow a lemon, what kind of soil do you need to grow a lemon, like the very basics of lemon as a physical existing object. And then the XYZs of Elimin is a examination of the verbal English concept of a lemon, of what it is to be a lemon or have a lemon, meaning something that is in some way broken or unfitting. The XYZs of Elimin is something, is what I think of as the queer way in, the queer path to lemons. And I think I mentioned earlier that part of lemons becoming a part of this vocabulary is the act of eating the whole thing. And one of the facts of being a gender non-conforming or non-binary trans person is the, I would say, a regular frustration with feeling partially seen. And there's a quote in the book that I made recently, it's three pages, and it says, "A whole lemon under one roof of your mouth." And I think that it sort of sums up where the XYZs of lemon starts from, which is this idea of, to eat a whole lemon is a commitment to the like refreshing brightness of the flavor, to the texture of the rind, to the acidity as it's going into your mouth. And what do you do with the seeds is a question that I ask myself, because I don't eat the seeds. So I don't eat whole lemons, I suppose, but that commitment to something that is not typically found or eaten. It is, like, yes, it is edible. Yes, trans people exist. You can love us, but can you love all of us, the whole person? And I've toyed back and forth with how autobiographical this piece can be or should be. Because like no trans person can speak for all trans people, of course, not by a long shot. And I think one of the things that is really particular about this is that it's just like, well, what kind of woman are you? There's a lot of varieties of women. That's another thing that's going to go into the ABCs. It's like, are you a Meyer lemon? Are you a yuzu, which is not technically a lemon? Are you, I don't know, what are you? But to be something that doesn't fit. It still has these approaches that are coming from, say, like children's television, like a lemon hat. I'm making a lemon hat. Costuming always cracks me up. It's my favorite part. I make my costumes. It's part of the fun. Like one thing that you don't see that often is a trans person that's like a news anchor. So that's one of my characters. And what happens, but also like, how would you know? Like, yeah, I mean, some of us, we can like maybe see each other on the subway and like maybe give a nod, but also you don't want to give a nod, because if you nod to that person that, and you're like, oh, I think I can tell that you're trans, then like you might be telling them that they are insecure. Like not emotionally insecure, I mean, physically, like they might be in trouble.
And what form will the piece take?
What form will it take is a really good question. So my initial hope for the piece was that it would be a two-sided piece that would take the same, that would have the same soundtrack, and that the spaces of silence would be shared, but in different contexts. So perhaps, for example, if you are hearing crickets on one, and you're looking on one on ABC's side, what you are hearing is actual crickets. Maybe it's a shot of crickets, maybe it's just a night where crickets have context. They are diegetic crickets. And then on the XYZ's side, maybe you're just looking at somebody who's facing an audience and what you're hearing is crickets. And so one of the things that I haven't really talked about in terms of film theory is that I love reading about sound, like diegetic sound. How sound functions in a film is very interesting to me. And one of the things that I had been planning with this piece was that I would be a sort of third party next to the work. Occasionally, say, you see a person speaking on the ABC side. You see somebody on the XYZ side lip syncing that same thing. So the way that, that audio can fluidly move between different video contexts was part of the focus of this piece. At this point, because of COVID, I get to work on those things, but understanding where they will land is not something I know. Most of the, you know, exhibitions are canceled. Unless it's something that I'm gearing towards Zoom, which I'm not, it's not impossible, but I don't think I want the first iteration of this piece to be geared towards Zoom. So I'm currently thinking of it as something that will be made and then shown. And it may be shown as two separate pieces. It might be shown together in a split screen, depending on how shooting goes. There's lots of options, but I'm not sure.
And can you just characterize how this idea of ventriloquism works in relation to this piece?
Well, there's two sides of that. And one of them is just like, is that way that ventriloquism is a good way to talk about, say, like lip syncing. The idea of one voice occupying another body is very interesting to me. And I'm also interested in the way that ventriloquism has functioned through history in terms of things like exorcisms and prophecies, like the Oracle at Delphi, these kinds of things that while it might not be ventriloquism the way that we think about it in 2020, it's still the act of, say, a voice of authority coming through a medium. And so even though I mean, at this point, I'm almost certain to be the only character visible on screen, or not the only character, there will be multiple characters, but the only body of visible on screen, I also have not ruled out the idea of other people's voices, but also other digital manipulations of my own voice. Digitally manipulating my voice is something I've been doing for a few years now. Some in live performance with just a yak back, actually, which is like a 20-year-old toy. So at the moment, lip syncing my voice, lip syncing my own lowered voice is part of what I'm up to, but also doing live looping. That's something I've done in several performances. But the other thing about ventriloquism that I think is really interesting is another sort of like biographical, not autobiographical, but biographical fact, which is there was a ventriloquist on British TV in the 60s named Terry Rogers, who was a trans woman, extremely passing trans woman. You would never know meeting her, but she had a dummy that was male, and ventriloquist gender switching is just normal. That's just part of ventriloquism. And the idea of the ventriloquist being the proper person and then the dummy or dummies enacting some sort of risque life to get outside of some sort of, like, I don't know if this is just British, but like the properness, getting outside of that to say what they really think, and also to enact a very bizarre sort of like class conversation between the ventriloquist and the dummy. But the thing that's so interesting about Terry Rogers, and I keep watching her films, or like what documentation there is of her over and over again, is that it's like an affirmation of her femininity, how uncanny it is to see her male dummy speak. Because she's quite good. And when her dummy speaks to her, it completes the illusion of ventriloquism because her voice control is so good. Her voice, her own bodily voice, I don't have the vocabulary here. Her own bodily voice is so feminine, and her dummy's voice is so masculine that it is almost impossible to believe that they are coming from the same person. And any doubt that you might have upon looking at this trans woman, which you probably just wouldn't because she doesn't, quote, look trans at all. Any doubt you might have looking at her is dissipated by her dummy. And one of the things that she does in one performance it's on YouTube, is she says, or she introduces the dummy, and then the dummy says, "Ladies and gentlemen, and those of you who are not quite sure," and then continues to go on. And that moment feels like an anchor to me right now for this piece. The XYZ side of the Element Project has become very focused on Terry Rogers, whether or not that's a fictional Terry Rogers that I'm making up, or what little I may be able to find out about Terry Rogers, the real person. I'm not sure.
Now it actually seems crucial that you have to come to the UK.
It really does.
Yeah, thank you. I think that seems like a good place to finish, because it's been quite a rich conversation.
Yeah, but I really haven't talked or thought about my like early theater experience in a very long time. So I'm really glad that you asked about it today, because it's grounding.
Great.
You've been listening to Lend Me Your Ears, presented by Duška Radosavljević, curated by Flora Petrolo, and produced by Tim Bano. The Lend Me Your Ears podcast is part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC leadership fellowship held by Duška Radosavljević at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.